This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George. I want to welcome a special guest today with me, Dr. Annette Bosworth. She is a physician and also, like myself, a small business owner, and she's actually running for Senate in South Dakota. I wanted to have Dr. Bosworth on because we talk a lot in the show about how the government is intruding on personal choice. And I talk about physicians being able to run their business and run their practice and treat their patients without government intrusion. And fortunately, blessed that I have never had that personal experience of being stepped on. But Dr. Bosworth actually has a very interesting story, and I wanted her to come on and tell us about it. Welcome, Dr. Bosworth, to Medicine on Call.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, I know that you are a small business owner. Can you just tell us a little bit about what kind of physician, what kind of medicine you practice, and about your medical practice itself?
Right. Well, thank you. Yes. I am an internal medicine physician, and for explaining that one, my dad is a farmer from South Dakota, and about 10 years into practicing, I found a definition that helped him completely understand what I do. I said, "Dad, I think a lot about really hard problems." And most internal medicine doctors, we start at puberty and we take them to the grave, and we integrate a lot of the prevention health as well as the adult health issues into practice. I have a specific attraction to the neurosciences or the brain health, so I do a lot with depression and bipolar and sleep and dementia and Parkinson's. So lots of brain stuff in my practice, mm-hmm. but I'm a general internist.
And I would assume that knowing that those diseases are chronic, this is about management, not only of the patient, but I would imagine the family as well, no?
Right. You know, that's been one of the joys of being in internal medicine, much like family medicine, that there is the connection to the community through your patients. And in my training, I specifically sought out a training that was very, had a good foresight into training us on electronic health records and how the information in medicine helps us see a bigger picture, even though we're seeing one patient at a time. The term for that is called informatics, or taking the information in medicine and using it within your daily practice as you see each patient. And one of the best connections through that while communicating with the patients has been that I am a completely electronic-based practice. And for a private practice, that's a unique setting. But I'll tell you, the reason I've really stayed strong at being electronically based has been for my dementia patients, that when I communicate to the family, there is through a portal, through a communication base, not just about their visit, but about any of the questions the family has, it totally is transparent to the family what the patient is requesting, what their complaints are, and then most importantly, what we're doing to help their loved one with their very difficult stage of life of dementia.
Sounds,
it's been a wonderful connection that way.
Yeah, that's different. I've never really thought about that, but that's the ability for, you know, someone, I know how this works. People come in to see you. You explain whatever you're going to explain, and then they leave your office, and they don't remember anything that you said. And
that's terrible. Right.
It's not even with dementia. So you're saying that
even
now.
Even without dementia. You
exactly.
Know, you bring in, we're internal medicine. On average, it's 5 problems we take care of at each visit. And, you know, I do this so many times that I will think the patient is connecting with what I'm saying, but mm-hmm. I've learned that I have YouTube videos that I have them go watch. They're really exciting. It's me. But explaining some of the things that I want them to remember so they can go home, they can go on to YouTube, they can use a little worksheet that I've given for them that has blanks in the worksheet to say, when you're watching the YouTube video, I want you to be able to answer all these questions, you know, maybe 5 or 10 questions. But it keeps them engaged, and not only that, it translates that information to the family, with or without dementia, but just another way to extend the educational component in medicine, which is, I think, our primary role as physicians.
I agree, and that's one of the most important parts of the doctor-patient relationship. And I would think, too, that with this system, it's more of a team approach. It's not just you telling patients what they need, but it's actually you with the patient and the family working together to figure out what's the individually best treatment option. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It doesn't sound that way at all.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the key things that happens in my practice, you know, I describe my practice as 2 years in the future. When I lived in Utah, I was surrounded by innovators. We were all trying to improve on these problems. I moved back to South Dakota, where I'm born and raised, and there is not that innovation as prevalent in my medical community here. So as I've looked at how can this example be translated, one of the last assessments I had on my practice, because of the way we do things, they register online, they get their labs online, not just the numbers, but a letter from us explaining what does the LDL cholesterol mean, what does it mean to have a 14% chance of a heart attack in the next 10 years using Framingham-Risk data. You give them that in the context of an appointment, and it kind of glosses over, like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. But when you can give them the information 2, 3, 4 days ahead of that appointment, where they've got their lab data back, I've assessed it, I've analyzed it with their history in mind, and then they read it in their own home, and then they call their sister, and then they call their preacher, and then they talk about all their labs to say, now they've come in. They've really digested the data that I want to go through with them. And many times they've Googled on their own, well, doctor, it doesn't look like I need to start a medication if I lose some weight. I'm like, you know what? That's exactly right. You know, those conversations become less like performance anxiety of the moment of, oh, I'm with the doctor. I have to make sure to ask all my questions. That becomes less intense and becomes a better conversation of care. And so we've really used that electronic arm to be a very valuable way to serve patients. South Dakota is a large state, and I have patients from across the state, and that has led to patients sending me a picture of a rash, and it's February, and it's snowing out, and they describe the rash, and I know the patient well, and it's shingles. I can see it from the picture and the story. And to come into my office would be 3 days in the future, and it would be a delay, or they would have to go to the emergency room. But using that electronic arm and that advanced communication, which is private and in a protected form, allows me to send that prescription into a pharmacy that's just down the street from where she lives, and then follow up in a week to show me how the rash is doing. So the care gets given without the crisis of being disconnected from your physician.
Now, you're speaking about the best part of electronic medical records, and I think that you're using it in a way that it was intended to be used.
But right, as opposed to what our federal government is attempting to do.
Exactly, and that's what I actually want to get into, because I wanted to paint a picture of what physician is supposed to be, you know, how you're supposed to have a communication and a camaraderie with your patient. And you can use electronic medical records to enhance that, but they don't take over for it. And I noticed, too, that you were individualizing your care. So it's the patient now taking control of their health care, realizing, I don't want to be in a ton of drugs. I want to fix the problem, not treat the symptom. Now that I've laid out, and that you've laid out beautifully, what it's supposed to be, first let me ask you the question. I have to ask a loaded question. Are you for or against Obamacare?
I am against Obamacare. The platform for which this information is being reported is to the arm of our government that should not be trusted with such information. And I think there is where my heart sinks every time I look in the future to say, play this forward 2 years, where I do a great job of collecting the data for my patients. It's in an electronic health record. I can use it as a teaching tool for my team that, you know, we only hit 50% of our flu shots this year. We need to be able to hit a 70%, you know, capture rate in the next year. Or our blood pressures weren't under control. We can use it as a quality reporting process that helps us be better clinicians. What it shouldn't be is a scolding, a carrot and stick model of let me pay the doctors better if they do a better job. Although I think, you know, honorable recognition or recruiting people to your practice because you're known for giving great care is a wonderful thing to keep in our market. That's why I collect my data and I publicize my data.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it should be a place where the government comes in to say, you know what, she's got no birth control. Or what one of the saddest stories is I referred for no abortions in a clinic that was known for being a high referral rate, and I got targeted from our government. And it was an unbelievable act of what happens when government gets too big. And I think it's the best lesson to foreshadow what happens when you give this information to the federal government.
Explain that again. I'm not sure that the listeners understand exactly what you mean. Be more specific about how they targeted you and why.
So there was a clinic here in town, a shelter actually, run by a federally paid program, a state paid program, excuse me. And I'm a business owner. I'm a primary care. I don't work for the, I'd take Medicaid, but that was about it. So a friend of mine was running the shelter, and she said, yeah, this is, we're on a budget. The health care costs are outrageous. And I said, well, let me take a look. And they're treating teenagers, the high-risk teenagers, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And I said, well, good grief, look at how poorly you're using the way medicine could be done. I'll save you $200,000 in the first month. And they were, 6 weeks from closing their doors, they were so out of budget. And she laughs and thinks, no way, but what do you have to lose? So I set up my clinic inside this shelter, and before they could go to the ER for a headache or before they could manipulate their way into, a continuous complaint of a problem that was really psychological as opposed to organic. And the only way you would know that is if you're involved in their lives. These are very distressed teenagers. They're coming off of marijuana. They come from very broken homes. They have not felt love, in a while because of the distress in their home. And you're never going to get that in an ER. So I'm in their life. And there's only 65 kids at that time, and we save them $200,000 the first month. And then we do it several months running, where this is your tax dollars that we're paying for this health care. And we dramatically shift the care, not just because of the electronic health record, but because we were truly involved in the lives of these kids. But what I didn't know is that before me, this is a place for teens to come in crisis, specifically the crisis of an unwanted pregnancy. And I have a handheld ultrasound that is the size of my iPhone. I take it when I do mission trips to Haiti. And I've learned that if you want to help someone understand the decision they're making, you should introduce them to their baby. And I actually stopped using any words. Usually there's a couple telling me about their problem, and they'll be up on the table, and I'll have the boy hold the ultrasound while I find the baby. And usually the next words to enter the room are from the boy saying, is that our baby? And they go from identifying a problem to a baby, and we talk further about what to do next. The point of that is I didn't appreciate that I was stepping into a place where this had been a number one referral place, and now there wasn't any. And 6 months later, there's an anonymous letter saying, since Dr. Bosworth has been in that program, which is paid for by our tax dollars, there's a dramatic shift in care. Now, they didn't explain it. They didn't have to. This is called whistleblower rules, but I'll never know my accuser. But they put that into the federal government, the state government, and they say, we need to investigate what she's doing. And if they investigate you, all the money stops. So the cost of their vaccines, the cost of their birth control, the cost of their pills, I had to either say I'm going to walk away because there's no money, or I'm going to know that this is what I was called to do and that I'm making a huge difference, and that's why they're investigating, is because it's such a huge difference, and that I need to stay present however I can find a way to do that. So I sought legal counsel and said, you know, I can run every report you can possibly think of. I am fine. I have not broken any rule. I have evidence-based medicine. I can show you where every penny has gone. I will have no problem proving my innocence. Will you walk with me on this story? And my legal counsel at the time was our late Bill Janklow. He was our governor, not at the time, but has been our governor for 16 years. And he says, yeah, I've got your back. And so I proceed. And in order to keep this shelter open, I shed my assets. I sold our lake cabin and our boat that went with it and my kids' college education to keep the cost of this clinic covered while we proved to Medicaid that this investigation was worthy of good health care. This is what it looks like to change a process. And I did great until the legal counsel that I had ends up on the front page of the newspaper with a brain tumor, and they proceed to raid my office, looking for there's got to be something further. And I think the point of the lecture, or the point of the story, is not how much loss I took from all this. I mean, 2.5 years of never getting paid for serving the poorest people in our community. It is that look what the government did, despite doing the best care this clinic has ever seen. I saved them money. I had outcomes that showed if you really want this, you know, drug-addicted teenager to not relapse, he is illiterate. And when your literacy doesn't get connected while in treatment, you're going to relapse. I had unbelievably rich data to show this program is changing the lives of these kids. But that didn't matter. There was a mission behind the investigation because it had disrupted the flow of money. And therein lies the problem with the federal government running this, is if they didn't agree with what I was doing, such as no referrals to the abortion center, that was their power, their unlimited resources, to continue to attack, to the point where last year in November, this is South Dakota, remember, I was still fighting this fight. I had moved out of the shelter by this point. The shelter closed 2 months after I left because of no one else would do that good of a job, and they were out of budget within an instant of me leaving. And I sold our primary home where I raised my three sons and my husband and I live. And we moved into an RV, a 1993 RV donated to us by our church, to say, I refuse to sign the piece of paper that I did anything wrong. I have all the evidence and the data to prove that I didn't do anything wrong. And this is what an attack looks like when the federal government, a distant arm, a big brother from afar, tries to micromanage a population of patients. Is that I don't care how good of a do-gooder you are, what your intentions were, when they start to attack, this is the result.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that dizziness may be a sign of heart disease, iron deficiency, high or low blood pressure, low blood sugar, or an inner ear infection? Dizziness can take the form of a spinning sensation, also known as vertigo, or a feeling of lightheadedness. The individual can also feel faint or have a rapid heartbeat. If you take high blood pressure medication, remember to take the medication daily as directed to control your blood pressure. Diabetics must remember to eat after taking their medication and to eat at regular intervals. If you have anemia, make sure to take a multivitamin that contains iron and to eat vegetables such as spinach. Dizziness after a cold or flu may be due to a virus. If you have dizziness, it is important to see your doctor for a complete physical examination. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George and my special guest today, Dr. Annette Bosworth, who's running for Senate in South Dakota. Prior to the break, she was letting us know a personal and insider view of what happens when you actually practice excellent medicine. And Dr. Bosworth, on the break, I was thinking about why this happened to you. And I think the main thing that targeted you was the fact that you stopped the abortion train. And I can imagine it's going to be, that's just one aspect that'll target docs. I think if you're against vaccines, for example, that'll target you. If you don't want to put your senior citizen in a hospice, but you actually want to practice, you know, they're healthy, they're vibrant, you want to give them every option to stay healthy and to, you know, use whatever arsenal you have, you're going to be come after by the government. I mean, I see this as a collectivist, centralized system where whatever they say goes. They have beaten us into submission as a group, as physicians. Either they're holding our pocketbook hostage or they're our licensure hostage, and we're running in fear. And when you're afraid, you do whatever.
That was exactly the tools they used, too. When I wasn't complying with what their, you know, I wouldn't sign this piece of paper that said I did anything wrong, because I don't believe that you should be sending teenagers to an abortion. I strongly think that they, when they see it's a life, you're going to see a trajectory change their whole pathway if you help them facilitate this choice that they feel, you know, because of our laws, is an option. And, you know, there's the next team of people they involved in my, you know, my persecution was the medical board. I mean, it didn't matter that I did great care, that I had been flown to the White House for being one of the best innovators serving the poor. And South Dakota has four of the poorest counties in the country. It, I mean, didn't matter that I was doing that work. What mattered was I was an outlier, somebody who stood outside the pack and did it differently. And when you look at the danger of what happens with socialism, it is if you are in the herd and thinking just like they want you to, no problem, you'll be just fine. But if you have the courage to stand on your faith and on your morals to say, God has asked me to use my talents in my profession of healthcare, and I am not going to compromise what I think happened to this country when we decided by the laws of our land that faith, that our lives had no value. When life has no value in the womb, that translated to a cultural message that changed and shifted the direction of this country. And as a physician, when I'm sitting there in the most distressed moments of a teen's life where they're having a pregnancy they didn't want, and now they think the answer is just get rid of it, do the quick answer. That is most of what you see. It is not the, oh, I had, you know, they talk about the rape or the incest that, you know, don't you want to keep abortion around for those reasons? And even in those settings, there is a message in that life that's in your womb. And how that plays out is to be honored as Christians.
I absolutely agree with you. It seems like being a Christian in this day and age it's being targeted. And if you're not Christian, but you have, if you're against abortion or you're against what the, and it sounds all trite and liberal media, but that ultimately the progressives, which are really socialists and communists and who really want to use the bully pulpit against people. And I think it's all about making people, as soon as you put your, you're absolutely right, as soon as you put your head up to try to be an individual, somehow you're a label, racist, sexist, you hate poor people, you want people to die. I mean, that's what they do. They label you to try to shut you up. And it's about time that, thank God that you exist and that you're doing what you're supposed to do. And I know that you're running for Senate, and I'm sure they're coming after you, trying to demonize you. Can you give us just the flavor of what that's been about?
You know, I have not dreamed of being a senator. I did not pray that this was where my life would lead. But I also pay attention. And I have never considered that my role prior to the last 3 years would be anything close to politics. But in this process of delivering care that was strikingly against the opposition, it was not the establishment, and then watching the power of what happens when government decides to put you in their crosshairs, and then looking at their unbelievably unrestrained power to attack. And then as I journeyed through this, we moved out of the RV when they sold it in May. And my family continues to journey in a way that we are very proud of, in that we made the right decision. But it has been a very painful process where our life of abundance, mommy was a doctor doing great work. You know, I live very conservatively, but I didn't have debt. That's why I was able to sell all those assets to keep that shelter open. But once all the assets were gone and we're living in a donated RV, they bring to you this piece of paper that says, you know what, we haven't found anything yet, but we can keep looking. We'll stop investigating you if you sign away all the money that we would owe you for the last 2 years of work. And so then you're 41 years old with 3 children and a medical degree and a drive to change things. And you're saying, is it about the money, or is it about showing that I didn't do anything wrong and the kids got better care and the lives were saved?
Now, you said something very interesting. It's like you were guilty until proven innocent. It was proved that you didn't do something. It wasn't.
Right.
It's the absolute opposite of what a criminal gets. What a criminal congressman gets, benefit of the doubt. Those people are committing crimes left and right up there, and they're still on the case. We've had people who are pedophiles, felons, thieves, and they're still proselytizing like they're moral, upstanding citizens, and you are doing God's work, what you were put on this earth to do, basically, and you didn't commit a crime. You helped people, and you now have to prove that you didn't do something wrong.
And that is the key to where I am absolutely opposed to what Obamacare has done. It is under a department of the law that does not have due process associated with it, just like what happened to me. All of this was under something called an ALJ, administrative law judge, excuse me, took me a minute to remember those letters. And that is not a due process. There is one person deciding how this, in hopes to expedite the case. There is now one person in charge of the decision. It is not under due process. I never got to meet my accuser. Not once.
So it sounds like FISA court.
Mm-hmm. And that is where Obamacare lies. If you want to fight it, if you want to say, I don't want to have my business pay for abortions, there's only a fine. There's not a way to fight it. There's a daily fine for that. Not a way to fight. This is not what I believe in.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way, but you're right. The Hobby Lobby business is just one example of that. But as individuals,
exactly,
when you join those exchanges, if you have a moral and ethical religious objection to abortion, you're now complicit because your tax dollar is being used to pay for them by federal employees. Because part of their mandate is any insurance company that a federal employee joins has to offer abortions as part of their cafeteria of options. So they get you coming and going.
It is an absurdity. It is an absurdity. This cannot be happening in America. It cannot. And that is where my voice became. I mean, there was two things. I am also what they call a patient-centered medical home, and that means that if you look at the layers of Obamacare, this is a very advanced status in Obamacare. And now that makes it sound like I'm for this, but a patient-centered medical home was here long before Obamacare. I mean, these were the people saying in a patient-centered medical home, we do the things that I was describing at the beginning of this interview, which is We are a team taking care of a process in the health and lives of our patients. We own the data. I'm a private, small business. I don't sell my data. I don't give it to anybody. I don't share it with the government. It's mine. It's not in a big hospital where 750 doctors can click on it and see the answers to what you've just said. It's a small, private business. And with that, I can run reports to prove that I am patient-centered medical home. And they give you a smorgasbord of options to say, what can you run these reports to say that you have patient-centered medical home? And one of the options was, doctor, can you tell me all of the patients in your practice that have a gun in their home?
That was
and
a question.
I just stopped saying, we've got to have somebody on the front lines running and speaking the language of a physician, of a very advanced informatics-based physician that also stands on the principles and has been tested to the point of moving my family into an RV in the wintertime in South Dakota, an old RV. There was no running water by the second week. I couldn't keep them from freezing.
Oh, wow.
to be in the U.S. Senate, because that is where the fight is. That is where the fight is. And that's why I decided to run.
Well, I think there's, I have no other words to say at that point, except let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
Healthcare Consumerism Radio. Learn, connect, share. Join us every Friday at 11 o'clock to learn all those confusing issues around healthcare, Obamacare, Medicare, Medicaid. We'll help you find the answers, help you stay in compliance. Join us Friday at 11 o'clock.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that eating too little and skipping meals can actually cause you to gain weight? When you do not take enough calories in, your body can actually stop you from losing weight. Your body works best when it is adequately fueled. If you fail to eat enough, your metabolism will slow down and your body will become stressed and actually hold on to fat. This will lead to muscle loss instead of fat. Exercise and lightweight training will increase endurance and muscle mass and will boost both your metabolism and your sense of well-being. Eat three well-rounded meals a day containing a lean protein, fiber, and a complex carbohydrate, such as a whole grain, with two snacks, such as fruits or nuts. These will promote healthy weight loss that is long-term. Prior to starting an exercise program, remember to see your doctor if you have any medical problems. Please join me on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. George, and our special guest today is Dr. Annette Bosworth, Senate candidate for South Dakota. And before the break, we were talking about the big foot of the government stepping on the necks of people who just want to be American citizens, who love their country, love their families, don't commit crimes, and are actually adding something to our society. Now, in the break we were talking, I wanted you to definitely get this on air. I know that when the government comes in, you're guilty until proven innocent. When they decide that they're going to come after you, they seize your assets, they can sell your assets. It's like a FISA court where one person decides your fate. You don't even know who accused you. It sounds a lot like peer review, which the hospitals are now implementing.
Exactly.
And you said you went up to Washington, you know, with the hope of getting support from Republican colleagues who should be happy that you want to, you really sacrifice yourself in order to help everybody. And what kind of reception did you get?
That was one of the best lessons of how broken the establishment is, that as I went into some meetings that are very supportive of the Ted Cruzes of the world, the ones who stand outside the pack, there were many more who said, we have a Republican candidate in the state of South Dakota, and we know exactly how he'll vote.
Oh, wow.
And I stood there with all the courage God gives me to say, well, that is why I run. The anger that I invoked was, I did not predict that. I work in a world of medicine where we are professionals. I mean, we are human. They don't always act like professionals. But for the most part, we work at a culture that is very professional in how we behave, how we handle disappointment, how we handle success. And I could not believe the intensity of the establishment when they specifically said, there is a good candidate. We do not want to lose this seat to a Democrat. And you are no one. And I could feel God help me. I mean, I do think God prepared me for this. That who in their right mind would go into a homeless shelter, give up as much as I gave up to keep it open? I mean, 6 months into this, I could have said, you know what, I'll pack up my toys, I'll move across the street and do no care for the poor, but still keep doing what it is that I'm doing, and I'm a good Christian, and I'll still go on my mission trips to Haiti, and I will deliver the care that I believe in. But I saw how much I was upsetting the establishment and how poorly the care was being delivered. I mean, these people would come in, these kids would come in with marijuana addiction, and on the third day they're going to have a headache. And so what would they do? They would send them to the emergency room. And the emergency room doctor doesn't understand that they're coming from a shelter, so he's doing everything in his power to make sure it's nothing dangerous, doing defensive medicine. And it's a teenager who's hot, you know, coming off of marijuana, so he's not giving them a good history. They do an MRI. They send him to a neurologist. You know, $70,000 later, that's your tax dollars. They were finally sent back saying, huh, we think it was nothing. And again it would happen. And now you stand up when you shift. You shift the needle, and you anger the establishment. And then you go to Washington, only to have the veins in the side of their head pop as they say, we have a candidate who has been in the establishment. We understand him. I could only just hear the whispers of, he's bought and paid for. Mm-hmm. We don't have any strings on you. And I could feel God say, stand still. I've got your back. I mean, had I not gone through the choice of, will I give in, will I sell the lake cabin, will I sell the boats, will I give up my kids' college education, all to give the resources to keep these poor children with the care that I thought they deserved. And as I did that, it was my money paying for that because I was under investigation. Where there's no money, I don't get paid for what I do, but I don't get paid for the cost of the supplies. I don't get paid to give money to my staff that was helping me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm paying for all of them. I'm paying for my electronic health record, which is, you know, those are very expensive things to keep open. And as I did this, each chapter of loss, it was a choice point. How much will you give to stand up for what I'm asking you to do? And you know, I've been to Haiti. I've been to the poorest parts of our country, which is in South Dakota. And I know what real loss looks like. And I am wealthy. I am a fifth-generation South Dakotan. I know many people in the state as far as friends and family that were willing to step up and help me. And by that I mean I would come home from the RV, we were living in the RV. It's wintertime. It's really bloody cold. One of the worst winters ever. And I would have never had enough Facebook friends. I would never have had enough people watching what I was doing. That I could come home and all the sheets would be washed, all the clothes would be folded, there would be a meal on my little counter there. And I would never know who did it. these are the kinds of people that South Dakota makes, and those are the voices that need to be represented. That you want to see a socialistic process where nobody steps up and does those kinds of things, that's what happens when the government is too big. When you leave no place for the churches to serve the underserved, then the control goes to the government, and this is what you get. And you stand up in Washington and say, I'm going to give you a new option, South Dakota. Will you choose a different option? And that is where the anger came from the establishment. Again and again. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they said that.
I believe it. You know, I've done this show for 3 or 4 years now, I think. And one of the things that, to me, is a theme that has stood out in my journey in learning about healthcare, about how it affects my patients and how to disseminate that information, that it's all about the money and it's all about who controls the purse strings. So if the government has been masterful at taking over various parts of our society. I was on an interview a couple of days ago and it became really clear to me. It started off way back, but the most recent iteration of it was the housing crisis, the foreclosure crisis, where they said, if you just give us all this money, just centralize it in the banks, and then they'll just make everybody whole and disseminate it. That didn't happen. People lost their homes. They lost their physical wealth from their homes, and the banks took it. They got 0% interest, and they're charging 30% interest, and they're making out like bandits. Now they're doing it to healthcare. Just trust us. We're going to take all your money, and everybody will have equal healthcare. It's a tax, which they're going to siphon out with like a vacuum from your pocketbook, and then give it back to you in the form of denials, pre-certifications, hospice, death panels. That's what they're going to do. And now you're telling me that in Congress, basically, the money that's the people that they can control, which is not a surprise, but it's all about the money. You're paid off, or you have some sort of skeleton that they're going to blackmail you on, and then they know what your vote is going to be. You are not part of that system. And I think it seems, at least on the surface, Senator Cruz and Senator Mike Lee, mm-hmm. that they're all voices that are outliers because they're not bought and paid for.
Right.
Now, one of the things that people ask, and I've heard this many times, well, why bother? It's just such a huge machine and you can't make a difference. Please tell my listeners why it matters, even if you're one voice, why it matters that you go there and you exert your own influence.
Absolutely. You know, have you ever been on a board?
Yes.
Have you personally served on a board?
I have.
Okay. Have you ever been on a board where you're the first woman to come into a group that has been all men?
Mm-hmm.
And it is amazing the dynamics that changes when you add both genders to a decision-making process. First of all, I've, of course, never been in a room of all men. I mean, just watching how that board runs, but I've had several people say, the reason I will vote for you is because of the ratio of men and women in the Republican Party. I mean, the Republicans have 4 women, and when they are in committee and they are looking at, there's a great post on Facebook that has all these men, I can't remember which committee it was, and they're these Republican men, which I'm sure are very well intended. But the behavior, the psychology, and the sociology of a group of all men is strikingly different than when you add a woman. And that is one reason that I run. But one of the best ways that you impact is that you support even the smallest of voice for change. And that's how we all begin. That's how Jesus began. Look at how many places he was attacked and persecuted, and that is where we belong as very faithful based Americans. That I know that Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, they were the enemy when I was in Washington last week. And we have a government shutdown. There's a shooting. I was on Fox and Friends for my voice on what I think should be talked about with Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And the voice of the establishment was, well, what do you think? You know, who do you align with? Who do you feel you look like as a senator? and I would always use Mike Lee or Ted Cruz. And you could just see the hair on the tops of their ears stand up going, not another one. And that's where the establishment needs to remember that it is this mosaic of Americans that makes up the U.S. Senate, not the career politicians that it is the next step in their career. It is the next rung on that ladder. They are not representing the people. They represent the bought and paid for. And I'm running against a lot of money. I moved my family into an RV not even a year ago, and I moved out of it because they sold the RV, not because life got better. And, you know, I believe in honoring God by praying bold prayers in His name. And I think that's how He honors the work, is that He answers bold prayers. And without the pain of the last 3 years, without removing all of the stuff, the earthly things, to sharpen my focus, I would have never had the strength to do what I'm doing. I would have had, just like every other American, the distraction of all the stuff instead of the drive for the change.
Well, when you get to Congress, when you get to the Senate, what would be one of the first things that you would, and it's a hard question, you may not be able to answer it, but what is first things that you would want to try to get?
One of the best things that I think the core of this process has always been that the government is too big. And so you look at the places where it has become ginormous, just out of control big. So big that most Americans don't understand it. I mean, I had this wonderful man I was on a plane with. He has graduated from law school. He's, you know, in accounting. And he said, it took me 4 days to do my own taxes, and I wasn't even that complicated. There's no way the American people understand how much they pay in taxes. And when you look at the Affordable Care Act, it is under the arm of the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
And I strongly believe that you reform our taxes. And I got a lot of pushback from this one in Washington as well, that you do something like the fair tax, where it is a consumption-based tax, where it rewards American businesses, where it gives them an advantage over imports, where it creates free market in a way that is beyond what we can imagine because it's never been there in my lifetime. And, oh, by the way, by a fair tax, by completely abolishing what the IRS is today, we don't have a place for Obamacare because it's under the IRS. And it is such a, you know, big dream of a revolution that, first of all, it just might work. But second of all, you get the establishment saying, you'll never be able to do it. You'll never be able to do it. You can't abolish the IRS. And my first retort is, they just abolished health care. They just took my private time of interviewing my patient and then took the data repository to say, you know, doctor, you won't get paid from your Medicaid and your Medicare, which are in the hearts of most doctors. We come to medicine, to the table, to say, I have a heart for the elderly and the poor. That's why I'm doing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But you aren't going to get paid for that service unless you give us the data that goes with it. And that is the, you know, did they all get vaccinations? You know, who uses marijuana? I mean, the patients aren't going to tell me the truth. Do you have a gun in your home? Why would you need that information? That doesn't help me be a better doctor.
Well, it helps you become an agent. It helps you become an agent for the government. And that, to me, is the whole crux, part of the crux of Obamacare. It's a database. It's a treasure trove of personal information that potentially could be used against you. And from what you're telling me, I wasn't far off by thinking that.
Well, there's a great history lesson that if we're not... When they were looking at schools in the South, there's a wonderful history lesson of how badly our government has abused this in the past. So they had a list of who is black and who is white. And the black students went to one school and the white students went to the other school. And four generations later, and many laws of equalizing the opportunity surfaced, but still, the cost to educate the white person was 8 times higher than what they were spending on the black person. So they went back to the list, and in order to make budget, if anywhere in the lineage of your history there was any black person, they would take the white child and put them in the black school because the cost of their education would decrease. And that is a great example of saying when you give information to the government, the leadership changes hands, the motivations will change, but the data stays. And how they will manipulate it, how they will use it is so unknown. I couldn't imagine that they would care about a list of who has guns in South Dakota. For heaven's sakes, it's South Dakota. It should be how many guns are in your home. I mean, we are South Dakota. But they will use it. I have no doubt that they will use it.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Have a fear of how badly they'll use it.
I absolutely agree with you. I'm going to give you another example that I just read last night. It's not the government per se, but it's unintended consequences, for example. When
exactly.
You go on these exchanges, they're asking you at the end of some of the, I don't know if it's the general, I think it is the regular government website. At the end, the last question is, what's your credit score? And the reason that they want to know that is if you are deemed worthy of the insurance company of coverage, because if you have issues, then you're not going to pay their premium. Well, I mean, or you're not going to be able to pay the deductible. Who knows what it is? But the bottom line is they're culling people left and right. So you think you're going to get a free health care. There's all sorts of things, demographic information that they're gleaning from you that will be used against you. This is just one example. You're talking about bigger things like having a gun in the home. What happens when there's some sort of public emergency? They know who's got the guns and they're coming for your house first. Shoot first, ask questions later because you're armed, quote unquote. Or you've taken a depression medicine to stop smoking, for example. Or you're grieving and you're taking your depression medicine. You're on a list now that you can't get a gun or you can't get a government job or you can't get, you know, you can't become a contractor for the government. Who knows where it stops? I don't trust
them.
Man.
One of the dangers that medical boards have done in the last years, and this was another thing when they were looking at how can we best represent, or when the medical boards were looking at my story after I had been at the shelter, the question, I've never had a mental illness. I don't have any history of it, but they attack that saying, let's call her crazy because then we can get her out of medicine. I mean, the power that the government and the boards that are acting like government. I mean, mm-hmm. One of the lessons in South Dakota is before I decided to run, I did what I call a listening tour. And I would go ask, has anybody interfered with your ability to do business? And there's something in South Dakota called a weed board, W-E-E-D, like as in the bad plant. And I don't mean marijuana, I mean weeds. It's South Dakota, and there's some naughty weeds, and you should take care of them if you own land. But some people wouldn't, and so then they decided the way we were going to handle this is the weed board. And the weed board strong-armed with unbelievable power for things that had nothing to do with weeds. But because they had the power, and they live in a culture where if you have the power, if you are the government, we have said as a society, bow down, listen to them, don't fight. And then watch what the weed board does. I mean, bizarre, but true. And that's the cultural lesson that's being learned by what does it look like to live in a life of big government.
It's not just big government, too. It's also corporatism. So you talked about how the money flows and how people are bought and paid for. But who's buying them? It's Monsanto. It's the pharmaceutical companies. It's medical device. Well, I apologize, not medical device, but medical insurance industry. The unions. They all were complicit in creating this bill, this law, which literally siphons money from you into their coffers in one way or another. And it's about removing competition. And I see now, for me, and I want you to speak to this, once they have the patients, they've taken you, they've taken your money, they've put you in this grid, They need doctors to be part of this. Right now, they're giving us kind of a pass because it's a soft stick. But what do you think is going to happen when the system is rigidly in place? They're going to try to do a lot with medical assistants and nurse practitioners and physician assistants, but you can't have them as surgeons. You can't have them as real, you know,
right,
down and dirty docs. Mm-hmm. How are they going to keep us in this system? What do you foresee the government doing to us to make us do this as slaves?
Oh, it will be so costly to have any kind of health care outside of the insurance processes that you will see all of the doctors become employed. I mean, I am one of the last little feathers of an independent practice that does 21st century medicine with electronic health records, with asynchronous care, with quality outcomes, with quality reports, not just to hang up a shingle and, you know, do it like they did it 30 years ago. No, that's not what I do. But I'm the lone one because the pressure to do what I do, it's unbelievable. I mean, one thing went wrong as I took on this, when I was working in the shelter. And by wrong, I mean no abortions. So one thing went right, but was against their grain. Mm-hmm. And the trickle of attack lost my home, and not from bankruptcy, but because I chose to say, I stand here to say someone has to do this. And that is the test that I believe has been the preparation to say, well, for heaven's sakes, run for the U.S. Senate, because that is where the fight is.
So what do you?
And I think they'll keep us in there are some physicians out there starting to do cash pay healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the revolution is, but those paying cash have to pay a fine to their government. That will be starting in January 1. Mm-hmm. Those fines will grow. The doctor has to pay a fine. They're not going to have a business that runs it any other way. And you will be the outlier. And that makes it so easy for them to attack you. And we must protect them.
Well, you know, I'm a big proponent of the Milgram experiment, where people joined or did an experiment where they would inflict pain on somebody because they were told to do so by the powers that be. There was one person who went in there and said, I'm not doing it. And then everybody else followed them and stopped it. So we now have 1 minute left, and I want to make sure that people can contact you. What's the best way to reach you?
Bosworth for Senate. www.bosworthforsenate. And there's a blog on there that says Ask Dr. Bos. And these are the kind of questions where, especially about healthcare and the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, that's a great place to put in the questions where the community can see it. So www.bosworthforsenate.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bosworth, for being a guest. I hope you will come back. I learned a great deal. I'm sure my listeners did, too.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It's been a nice conversation.
You're listening to Medicine on Call.